The Honorable Jean Sperling.
Thank you very much. In our sessions, in our five sessions, really as well as our plenary session on conflict, we have tended to focus more on education in primary and secondary schools, often in poor countries. When President Clinton saw our list, he felt it was important that we have at least one panel that focused more on higher education and perhaps more specifically on how it links in with strategies for economic development. And so this panel was truly his inspiration to kind of throw out the question, brain drain or brain gain, what were the different attitudes and philosophies on people moving across borders for higher education. When we met earlier in White Oaks, President Simmons was with us and others. This was a major issue that he thought would be worth discussing here. So with that, I'm going to turn over to our moderator. If you were trying to find a moderator to deal in the higher education issues, dealing with economics, et cetera, you might want to have a chief economist from the World Bank. You might like to have the former president of one of the United States' most prestigious universities, or you might like to have a major government official like Secretary of Treasury. When you can get them on one resume, that's a good moderator. So with that, my very good friend, Larry Summers.
Thank you very much, Gene, for those kind words. It's a lot better than the time I was introduced by the fellow who said,
Larry, do you know what it takes to succeed as an economist? And I said, no. And the guy said, an economist is somebody who's pretty good with figures, but doesn't quite have the personality to be an accountant. It was in Moscow, and no one got the joke. Which says something about something. We've got three terrific experts on various aspects of brain circulation and who play an important role in the process. Claudio de Moro Castro from Brazil is the president of the advisory council of one of Brazil's great higher education institutions. He's the chief education advisor to the American, the Inter-American Development Bank, which has done so much to develop higher education in Latin America, and is on the board of trustees of a major Latin American scholarship program for American universities. He manages to do all of that, and in addition, has written over 35 books, including such titles as Myth, Reality, and Reform, Higher Education Policy in Latin America. Professor Wiesman Nkulu from the University of Pretoria is now that university's chancellor. He's an acclaimed academic, an honored member of the accounting profession, a public figure and professional businessman. He has received awards on several continents for his achievements in education. John Chambers, the chairman and the CEO of Cisco, has led and built one of America's great companies. Their sales have risen by a factor of nearly 30 since he became CEO in 1995, and he has been recognized around the world for his visionary strategy, his ability to drive an organization that is both very large and very entrepreneurial, and for his warm-hearted and straight-talking approach, and in particular his deep commitment to ideas, education, and knowledge. In a sense, Professor Wiesman and Professor Castro represent institutions that are involved in the supply of talent, whereas as the CEO of a great global corporation, John Chambers is a demander of great talent for his company, and of course through his training programs, also involved in supply. Let me put to each of our panelists a question, starting with our Brazilian leader, and I will, if you'll pardon me, be slightly self-referential in asking that question. As president of Harvard, I was sometimes told two different things. Sometimes I was told it's absolutely crucial that Harvard do much more to train leaders, to train great scientists, to promote the interchange of ideas, and to bring many more foreign scholars to study at our university and give them more financial aid and support them in every way. Sometimes I was told it's a real tragedy the way Harvard seduces people from societies that desperately need them to come and study at Harvard, and they end up staying in the United States, benefiting enormously from the financial aid that their countries had provided them along the way as they were educated, and then staying in the United States and leaving countries that desperately need skilled people without enough skilled people. Which of those views was right?
Depends on the country.
In the first answer of any economist to any question,
right.
It depends.
Right.
Tell us about how you view that question in the Brazilian context.
In the case of Brazil, which is a very latecomer, in the continent where the first universities were created long before Harvard was created, Brazil only created its first university in the 30s, and it took a long time afterwards. But in the 60s, we started sending students to get their PhDs. In the 70s, they started coming back, including myself, and graduate schools were created, and a very powerful mechanism to evaluate graduate programs was put in place, by which not only schools got grades, but they got prizes. They got more scholarship for their own students. They got research grants, etc. So that created a growth in research, in which Brazil went from zero international publications to the 15th place in the world today. In other words, it went from 28 in the 80s to 15th now. And a very peculiar situation, we account for 2% of exports of science, and our exports of goods are just a little bit of 1%, so we export more science than goods. The result of that, which is very peculiar, is that we do have a serious brain drain. What is the problem? We don't have a brain drain. We need a brain drain. All our people return to Brazil. Very few leave. We produce 10 times more PhDs per year than the total number of Brazilian scientists abroad at any time. So we do have a problem. We need a diaspora abroad to open the windows, to refresh, to sort of broaden the horizons of our science establishment.
I feel your pain, though. I wonder whether I would rather live in a country...
I wonder whether I wouldn't rather live in a country that talent was trying to stay in than a country that talent was trying to stay out of. But I very much appreciate your perspective. How would you feel from the African perspective in South Africa, or more generally, if you look at the African countries, do you think the objective should be to encourage more people to leave or to encourage more people to return?
No, thank you very much for the question. The situation in Africa possibly is more complex. I would start by saying that brain circulation is good for both the source countries and also the receiving countries. The African countries have benefited a lot and continue to benefit from the opportunities to send their young men and women to come and study in the best universities in the developed countries. And that continued for a number of years, and all aspiring, competent young people would, even after obtaining the PhDs in an African university, would aspire to spend some time in a prestigious university in the developed countries. That was something that everybody encouraged. But an unusual situation developed in Africa during the 70s and the 80s, when there were push factors that really pushed professionals, scientists, to leave the continent in large numbers. I would say that there were possibly three factors. One, it was the conflicts, the breakdown in the economies of African countries. Add to that the structural adjustment. All those factors reduced opportunities for professionals in African countries, and they left in big numbers. So brain drain became a major issue in Africa. And of course, globalization and the increased demand worldwide for scientists during the 90s just was not helpful. But really, Africa has responded to that by, we examined it a number of times, this issue. How should we respond as Africa to the fact that now we have got net skills flight from the continent? One response was to say, let's bond our scientists, those who train in African universities, and make it difficult for them to leave. But I must say, after a number of studies, mainly conducted under the auspices of the African Capacity Building Foundation and also the New Partnership for Africa's Development, we came to the conclusion that it will be wrong to use legislation. What the emphasis should be on addressing the push factors in our countries at a political level, that is already being done through the reduction in conflicts, stabilization of our economies. But of course, the challenge is still to make sure that our higher education institutions, our research institutions have the necessary resources to actually make it attractive for our scientists to stay in our universities. That is not the case now. I would say that that's the biggest challenge. What I believe that Africa needs is policies to encourage as many African scientists, engineers in the diaspora to return to the continent, and we're doing that by creating the right conditions. And I believe that progress is being made in this regard, but of course the developed countries will always be more attractive because they will always offer better remuneration packages, and they will always offer better working conditions. So how do we deal with that? But I would say that the majority of Africans would still want to return to their countries because they feel much more comfortable in those countries. What really of late is making the situation even more complex is the fact that at international level there is an agreement that African countries must be assisted to strengthen their health systems. But we are finding that there is an increased, more aggressive recruitment of health professionals by some of the developed countries. And I believe that much as brain circulation is a good thing, we want our professionals to move to the developed countries and return to the continent, but these abnormal situations where we have got the management of African economy is improving, and we're actually building up our capacity, we're getting ready. But we find that possibly as a result of underinvestment by some of the developed countries in the training of health professionals, we have found this abnormal situation. We are well set to enhance our health systems, but really they are being taken away by the developed countries. So I would possibly end there and say that it's good for the African continent's brain circulation, but we had a net outflow as a result of those circumstances which we are addressing now, but we can receive... We expect more support from the international community, possibly in terms of more dialogue and possibly a code of good conduct. What do you do when, you know, the policies are right, but now some countries underinvest in critical areas where the demand for those skills increases in those skills, especially in a critical area like health? I believe that that's something that merits to be discussed at a forum like this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. A larger diaspora, people stay home, especially stay home because they're attracted by much stronger institutions, and especially in healthcare, which is critical. John, before you answer, I'll mention a third perspective that I heard at Harvard. One was, great thing to do, do more, help teach people. Another was, it's terrible the way you're robbing people from the rest of the world. And a third was, you're an American institution. Why are you training all these people to go home and help companies there beat American companies' brains in? What would you advise what would you advise great universities in the United States in terms of the posture they should take towards this issue?
Larry, both my parents were doctors, and they very early on taught me the difference between addressing the symptom of an issue versus the underlying issue. And the brain drain is an issue or brain gain of a bigger symptom. And you know this being an economist. The jobs are going to go where the best economies are that create the right education to enable people to get jobs that have the underlying infrastructure. And a large part of this isn't roads and highways. It's broadband infrastructure that create an environment in the country for identifying market transitions and innovation, which motivates people as well as creates wealth and multiple jobs on top of it, and something I wouldn't have said a decade ago with very strong supportive government tying it together. So really the underlying issue here is that countries must address all four, or otherwise it will show up as a symptom of either brain gain or a brain loss. Secondly, I think the discussion's over about countries and borders. I think it's going to be globalization, which should raise almost all boats around the world. So the jobs will go where the best infrastructure, education, innovation, supportive government exists. And our problem today as a employer of about 10 or 11,000 incremental jobs last year in 170 countries around the world is higher education is not training either in the skill sets we need nor with the right collaborative skills. So while we did Network Academies originally as a corporate social responsibility program, we're now in 169 countries, 2.3 million graduates, 575,000 students in the program. We go into Jordan or in Egypt or in India and partner with government in terms of education. We are not filling the jobs in the world in networking alone, 600,000 short this year. Within 3 to 5 years, 1.2 million short. So I think we've got to say, what are the underlying issues we're trying to fix here, and realize if we don't address this as an algebraic equation with both education, infrastructure, market transition, innovation, if you will, and supportive government together, we can do a lot of Band-Aids. But we all know in medicine, if you just do a Band-Aid or treat the symptom, it might go away for a short time, but the underlying illness will return.
Let me ask you one follow-up question, if I could, John, because I was quite struck by something you said in one of our earlier conversations. It's become a bit of a cliche that India and China graduate 5 times as many or 10 times as many engineers or scientists as the United States does each year. Some people say that's misleading because many of them aren't up to the standards of great companies like yours, and so the definition is really quite different. Other people say that it's the mark of a very serious problem, that we're producing only a tenth as many as major countries that we compete with. Which side of that argument would you be on?
I think the U.S. is underestimating the degree of the problem that we face here if we want to keep major high-tech and biotech companies in the country. No matter how you cut the numbers, the U.S. will generate 60 to 70,000. India will generate, as an example, we're very familiar, which we will be generating probably 10,000 jobs in over the next 5 years, 575,000 engineers this year. Now, you might say, Larry, but all the studies show us that they may not have the same skill sets as somebody trained here or in Brazil. But when you take the top 5% of a country, the best and the brightest, and they want to go into engineering, and you graduate 575,000 students,
regardless of the skill sets they have when they come out, that's the talent you want. So the best and the brightest in the U.S. may end up going into a number of different disciplines, from consultancy to financial services to lawyers, et cetera, and we're only getting a small segment of those going into engineering. So if a country's outproducing you 10 to 1, and they've got the best and brightest going there, the top 5%, unfortunately, that's going to be the country that's going to win for the jobs. And this isn't talking in theory. We are backing it up with our commitments and putting our globalization centers in India, a country that truly knows how to partner in a win-win environment. Now, I'd like to track as many of those graduates to the U.S. as I can and keep them, but you've got to look at where the market will be for the future. And I think that we've got it wrong in this country in terms of the transition that's occurring.
I mean, such a rich array of subjects here, but there's a clock here that's directed on keeping us. It's the Clinton Global Initiative, but they warned me that I was not to allow this panel to be on standard Clinton time.
Just for the record, Larry said that, none of us did.
So I'm gonna just ask. Moving from this more macro focus, each of our panelists starting at this end, a more micro question. If you could change one thing, and I'm going to be ruthless about saying only one thing, about the student experience at universities in your country to better prepare them to do their job of preparing people for the world, what would the single thing, the single message that you think universities and their faculties ought to hear and heed in terms of providing a better education that will contribute more to all the national goals in your country?
Public universities need to become a lot more international than they are. They are parochial. They're closed. Not completely, because many of the teachers have got their PhDs abroad, but the theses are not written in English, not enough foreign students come, not enough of their own students go abroad, not enough of the papers are published in English, even though there are strong incentives to publish in English. That's fair enough. So, but I think internationalization is the missing link at this moment, for the same reason that the low brain drain is very dangerous for the country.
I would say that in the case of the African continent, in particular South Africa, our greatest challenge is to ensure that the university graduates that we produce are equipped to actually enable us as African countries to deliver the essential services. We are the health. I mentioned the issue of health. I mentioned the education, water, and so on. What we have realized that our greatest need, the skill that is very short, is project management. And really, universities produce these people. They are accountants, they are engineers, but they don't have the integrated skill set that is required to actually enable us to really drive the delivery of these services and really get our countries to really achieve the Millennium Development Goals and also get to a high standard. I would suggest that that requires a combination of course, the best science that is available in the world, integrating the best technologies that's available, getting the skills from the developed countries to do the training in Africa, in African countries, and to make sure that there's relevance in terms of that training, and really but focus on what the higher education is about. That requires a better integration of science and technology, and really with a focus on the tasks that face us in Africa in terms of taking us to the 21st century.
Larry, I think we're still measuring education in an archaic way, and we talked about it the other day, on grades, where it's about how well you did versus somebody else. That's a command to control. That's an old world philosophy. The future is what you're seeing here at the Clinton Global Initiative, which is collaboration and using technology that our kids invented, this Web 2.0 social networking, to create an environment of ability to learn together and then to innovate together. And our universities everywhere in the world are missing that. We're preparing students for the past, not students for the future. So my wish would be to think more broadly about how do you teach collaboration and teamwork, how do you use these technology tools, especially Web 2.0 tools, to really create a generation of innovators who no longer are engineers or scientists or lawyers or economists or manufacturing or salespeople, but when I put them together in the company, I can move them from one job to the other, and they can work together in a collaborative group, not just in their skills that they learned in school, but an evolution of skills. That's the future. That's going to be the companies that win in the future, and that's the, what I need in terms of the job market.
How would you get there? What would the first thing you would do? You know, you got university, you got a group of buildings, you got a group of faculty, you've got 1,600 students or 1,000 students or 5,000 students who arrive freshmen, and you want to school them in this new new paradigm. How would you do it? You must have some relevant experience from your academies.
Well, both from the academies and also messing it up myself. I'm a command and control. The way I would have done it before is to say, all right, this is what we're going to do. Told two or three of my lieutenants to go implement it. The way it should be done is pick new students, some fourth-year students, some of your most creative professors, a couple of the leaders from the university, and say, tell me how we're going to make this transition together. And understand each of you have a different experience. Come back in 45 days with a plan to do it, and we're going to pilot it, and we're going to learn from the pilot and then move forward. The universities who do that right will attract talent like a magnet, regardless of where you are in the world. If you combine that with supportive government and infrastructure, those jobs will stay there.
How do you keep, Professor Weissman, how are you going to keep the most able people in the places that need them most when inevitably, for the same reason they're most needed, I'm thinking about healthcare, they're the places where in some ways there's more hardship in life than in other places. How can you really, what could we do to help you keep those nurses who are so important, those primary care physicians who are so important in the places where they're most needed in Africa?
I think the responsibility mainly is with the African governments themselves. Progress has been made in terms of improving macroeconomic management and also the way that skills, awareness about the importance of skills in actually, in government, in ensuring that governments are able to deliver. There's much more awareness now. So that awareness, in my view, the first, for us, for instance, when I was working as the chief executive of the New Partnership for Africa's Development, one of the breakthroughs that we made that we're very pleased with is that for possibly good reasons, the way which I never understood, that there was a phase when African universities really got very weak, were weakened because there was just no funding, especially from the international community. The focus was on primary education and so on. But we said, if now we say we want African countries to achieve 5% growth and be able to sustain high levels, how do you do that without the minimum managerial capacity? Where is it going to come from if the universities, we don't strengthen our universities? So I believe just by actually that paradigm shift of really understanding the critical roles of skills and taking measures to create the right conditions, that alone has actually helped and actually encouraged a number of professionals to consider professions in Africa. I would say that given that if there were no sort of serious shortages in some of the developed countries in the area of health, we wouldn't be experiencing the outflow of nurses that we are experiencing. I believe that if the African government, the expectation of our people understand that in terms of remuneration packages, they cannot expect to get the remuneration packages that they will get in the UK or anything like that. But they expect minimum respect as professionals.
minimum quantity of service. And I believe that we're moving in that direction and we're beginning to make success. I would say that the international community, including the universities, where they can be of help, is really working with African countries, African higher education, to strengthen the capacity of those institutions in Africa through partnerships and through other measures, exchange of faculty and so on. I believe that the environment is much more conducive now than it was during the 70s and the 80s. And really, we are on the right track. But really, on the developed countries, there mustn't be what I believe to be really a shortage. That is, in my view, of health professionals in some of the developed countries, that I believe is due to bad planning by the developed countries. You know, this thing about health professionals is abnormal in my view. It's an exception. Right. But under normal circumstances, you know, we're moving in the right direction, and African economies are beginning to grow, and I would expect more professionals, both African and non-African, to be attracted to consider careers in Africa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The clock is ticking upwards, which is, I think, a sign that it is time to move to your discussions at your tables, which I hope will address both the broad macro element of cross-border policies and also the specific things that individual institutions in all countries can do to strengthen themselves. Our leader, Gene Sperling, I think will have a word to say about the procedures here.
Well, first of all, I think in fairness to our leader, President Clinton, Larry and I do like to make jokes about President Clinton's timeliness, and I think that virtually everybody who knows us would think of that saying that has something to do with the pot calling the kettle black. So the one thing I wanted to stress that Larry said, for those of you who have been at the other panels, we have found it's been very successful to just ask the question of what are the two or three things that need to be done and who are the people who need to do them. I think in fairness to this panel, you really need a three-part. You really have to, I think, in light of this conversation, ask what is the specific problem you're trying to address? What are the few things most important to be done? And who are the people to do them? And so we will let you start that conversation, and we'll be back. Thank you.